Okay, welcome back to Q&A, folks. We're going to lead off. I have a little bit of a share on a new power toy, the Video Conference Mute. And this just came out this last week. And just to recap, power toys is a collection of utilities that work under Windows, so they're additional functionality that are put together by some of the people at Microsoft. Video conferencing mute. I have there the overview of what the this particular power toy actually does. That's the URL there that you can actually get the latest power toys from. What it actually will do is, with a single keystroke, you can toggle your video on or off, or toggle the microphone on or off, or both of them at the same time. And those are customizable keystrokes that you can set up however you want them to be. It works with more than just Zoom. It works with Zoom. I've tested it with Zoom and Google Meet, and I do know that it works with Microsoft Teams. Presumably, there are other video conferencing software that it'll work with as well. The best I can say right now is it's a work in progress. It works, but there are some issues with it. This is the main power toy utility, and you can see now down at the bottom left, there's a video conference as a new addition to it. And over on the right-hand side, you have the hotkeys you can do for either both camera and microphone, just the microphone or just the camera. If you have multiple cameras on your computer, you can select the camera. Camera overlay image is kind of cool, and that's where if you turn off your camera, it can actually display any image that you want. So you just point it to a JPEG or whatever, and it'll display that when you turn your camera off. You can set up the toolbar, which just tells you the current state for microphone and camera, and you can also click on each of those buttons to do it if you don't want to use hotkey, and you can say where you want that toolbar to be positioned, and if you have multiple monitors, what monitor you want the toolbar to actually appear on. Okay, and I highlighted this in green because this is the one sort of unique feature that isn't actually built into any individual video conferencing software. There's a picture of how the toolbar looks, and it tells you your status, and you can actually click where it says microphone on. You could click on that. It'll turn the microphone off. Click on where it says camera's on, and it'll turn it off and change the status of that. As I said, it's a work in progress. I think there are some things that they can fix. Right now, there is a problem if you have multiple microphones. For me, I have a microphone that's built into my webcam as well as my headset. It will only mute the microphone in the webcam. It won't do the headset. They are working on it. So that's a bug that they've admitted to, and they're working on it. The toolbar also doesn't scale to the Windows display scaling. So if you're on a high-res monitor, high DPI monitor, you'll find that the toolbar is actually kind of tiny. And when I reported that as a bug, they came back saying that they used a PNG instead of SVG file to display that, and that caused the thing not to scale with Windows. So presumably that's going to be fixed as well. Things that they can't fix, or more likely I think they just won't fix. In your video conferencing program, where you select the camera that your video conferencing program is going to use, you have to change it from your actual camera to select PowerToys Video Conference, and it will show up there. They actually install a driver on your system, and so it will show up in your video conferencing software as PowerToys Video Conference. You have to select that one. Some software, like Teams apparently, will select that automatically. If the Teams sees that it's available, it will select it. I had to go into Zoom and tell it that I wanted to use that particular camera. Another thing that they won't fix is that the Zoom toolbar doesn't indicate when a video conference has been muted using the hotkeys or the toolbar button. So Zoom can actually fix this, according to Microsoft. If they use a Windows API, they can actually see the status of the microphone and video. So you can see here, I have a mismatch where The microphone is off, but Zoom just shows it as being on, and likewise, camera's off, but the Zoom toolbar actually shows it as being on. So that's probably not going to be fixed by Microsoft. They're just assuming that if Zoom wants to fix it, they can. Do you need it? Probably not. All video conferencing programs do have buttons that can do the muting and unmuting for video and audio. But if your video conferencing program, you're using multiple ones, and you want a consistent way of doing it across the multiple programs, especially if you're using hotkeys, or if your video conferencing program doesn't have hotkeys and you don't want to reach for your mouse and click on that, you may want to use this program. And personally, I would say I'd wait for the PowerToy to evolve a little bit. There may be other functionality that's coming into it. So I just wanted to point it out as something that it seems to work sort of okay, not too bad, but that's about it. Okay, Alan, you could take it over. Oh, I had a comment here. Yeah, Alan unmuted it all. A number of YouTube videos showing how to repurpose an old laptop screen as a Raspberry Pi monitor. Mark commented on that in the chat. So if you are interested in using old laptop screens as a Raspberry Pi monitor. Over to you, Alan.
Okay, thanks. And good evening, everyone, to the Q&A session. I've got a couple of things to kick off with in terms of follow-up. Remember, Chris last week was demoing the Windows calculator, and I mentioned I saw something about bathtubs. And what happens if you put in a fairly large number of the conversion factors for volume, it will actually show you that, for example, if you ever need to know, 40 cups is about 0.02 bathtubs. I'm not quite sure what you use that for, but there it is. And Chris, we were talking about defrogging SSDs, and Chris found this. So, Chris? You're wondering what he found? No? He's not muted.
Sorry. Yeah, this month, just today, I noticed this on a couple of sites, that apparently the Windows update that came out for this month has a fix for that optimizing drives problem that we noted in a previous Q&A, where apparently SSDs were being defragged on every boot, which is not a great idea. And it only affected some people that were running the May 2020 update to Windows 10, but apparently it has been fixed now. The URL that you see on screen is one of the articles I read. So if you have taken to turning off defrag, in order to get around that potential problem, then apparently you can turn that back on.
And following up on that theme, we had talked about defragging SSDs and hard drives and this function called trim. There was no real surety about what trim was all about, so I had it a look. Because I actually did look at this a number of years ago from one of my Linux boxes. So if we think about defragging and trim, there's two real things going on here. If you have a completely electronic operation on the computer, such as the CPU, which is executing instructions or reading and writing to memory, electronic operations are really quick, really, really quick. But if you bring in a mechanical component, and so if you have like a spinning hard drive, or you have to move the read head, well, that's relatively slow. Now, I say relatively because the hard drive operations typically are in tens of milliseconds, but the electronic operations are in tens of nanoseconds, and nanoseconds are a million times faster than milliseconds. So there's a huge difference between electronic and electromechanical operations. Now, defragging, we all know defragging, you basically bring all the different blocks of a file back into one contiguous line, if you like, on a track on a disk. And how files get fragmented, if you write a file to disk and the operating system can't fit it into a single section. So here we're trying to write this red file, but it's more than a block, so the operating system writes a full block and then it has to stick the extra somewhere else down the track. So what happens now is, here's our head sitting right on top of the first track of the red file. So it immediately, as soon as it gets to the first track, it immediately starts to read the red file, and it can read the whole red file because as the disk spins under the head, all the red blocks get read into memory. Now the problem with the yellow file is the front of the yellow file is beyond the head, so it has to spin around until the yellow file comes around. So there's a certain amount of time there where it has to seek. But then the rest of the file is fragmented. So now once it reads the first part of the file, the head has to move over to the other track, and it has to wait until the second bit comes around, and then wait till the third bit comes around. So all these gaps in the process take time and slow things down. But remember, computers can multitask, so the CPU starts doing something else while it's waiting for the hard drive to complete its task. Now, solid-state drives work completely differently. Everything's in a kind of a memory. They use NAND flash memory. So they use things called pages as a minimum storage unit. And then they combine various pages to make one block. And the solid-state drive controller can read any page by simply pointing to a memory address. So it doesn't matter where that piece of NAND flash is, because they're all connected electronically, so it can find them, the individual bits, whether they're contiguous or not. And in fact, if they're non-contiguous, it might be better, because if you have multiple read channels, you can read different bits of the file at the same time and then combine them all in the right order. So it's a different way of doing business. And you can kind of look at it like this. If we have three blocks here, and the blocks are divided into these pages, and we've got a red file, and we've got an addressing scheme, and we're just using a simple block number one, page number one, block number one, page number three, and then the next part of the file is in block number two, page number one. And everything's connected, as I say, so you can just point to one of these addresses and read any page. Now what happens is, you can write data to any empty page in any block. And you can mark any page in any block as being deleted. The file is deleted, so that page is deleted. The problem is, the way NAND flash works, if you want to overwrite some of these pages, you have to basically zero all the pages. So you have to erase the whole block before you can write to a block that's been a page that's been deleted. So what has to happen is you have to read everything in the block into cache. So there's some kind of memory, RAM type memory associated with the SSD. So you read the block into cache. You throw the deleted pages away. The pages that are in use, they're part of another file. You have to write them off to another block. And you basically write them to another block because every time you write to things, you're wearing the SSD out. So they call this wear leveling. You write the thing to a different block and that hasn't been used for a while, if you like. And so over time, all of the pages in the SSD kind of get used equally. So when it fails, it's going to fail big time, I guess. And then once you've dealt with all the pages in this block, then you can erase it completely, and now you can write new material to it. So it's basically like this. Here's our original setup. We delete the black file, so we have to cache all the pages from block one. We throw away the black pages because they've been deleted. we have to write the red pages somewhere else, and the empty slots are in block three. And then once we've done that, then we can erase block one. So then once we've done that, here's our block three with the two new bits of the red file. And now we've erased block one, so that's available for reuse. And the solid state disk controller keeps track of things, so it knows that the first bit of the red file is now actually in block three, page one, for example. Now the problem is, this block erase, you have to read, discard things, move things, erase the whole block. That takes time. So if you want to do that when you want to overwrite a file, then you're going to slow things down. So you have this thing called trim, and it works in conjunction with a process called garbage collection. And the SSD controller takes care of all this stuff and makes this deletion process quite efficient. So what happens is when you delete a file, this trim process marks the pages as being deleted, so our black pages, for example, and it tells the SSD controller that this block is ready for garbage collection. And now here's the tricky bit. When the system isn't busy, remember that multitasking operation, when the system's not busy, then the garbage collection process starts up, and it moves the red pages off to another block somewhere. It throws the black pages, which are the deleted file, throws those away, and then it erases everything in that block one, and it's ready for reuse. Now, I said I had a look at this because a number of years ago, I was running Ubuntu, and I installed an SSD, and there was some discussion in various forums about whether trim was active or not. And somebody came up with some magic Linux commands, which told us what was going on. So my commands here are in the red. So there's a dd command, which is the standing joke for Linux admins is dd is disk destroyer. It's a kind of a copy move type command, but if you get the command wrong, you can end up deleting the whole file, the whole disk. So you have to be somewhat careful with the dd command. But basically, what this is doing, it's creating a file called temp file, a temporary file, and it's filling it with random data. And then we use an hdparm command, hard disk parameter command, to find the starting block of that temporary file. And then once we know that starting block, we read the sector and see what data's there, and the block below shows you that you've got random hexadecimal numbers in that temporary file. So we created a file, we filled it with random numbers, and now we delete that file. So we use a remove command, the rm command, remove the temp file, and now we manually run trim, and Linux has a command called fstrim, file system trim. So we run the fstrim command, and then we also flush the disk buffers, the cache, so that anything that we've deleted is not stored in cache. And then finally, we run the same command to look at the sectors of that file, and now we can see that they're all zeroed. So, in other words, when you run trim, you basically zero the various blocks that are associated with the file. And if that doesn't make complete sense, then these are the references I kind of took a lot of that stuff from, and they'll be on the Q&A website later on. So feel free to take a look at those at your leisure. And now Chris has got some words on disk recovery, and again you have another deck. Chris, unmute yourself.
I was trying to be polite and mute myself, and then don't remember to unmute myself. So, okay. So, disaster recovery. I recently ran into a need for this myself. So, just as a bit of a recap, why we back up. We don't back up for backup's sake. We back up so that we can recover. So, it's important to know whether you can actually recover or not. An untested backup could be worthless, and an untested recovery process might not work. So it's good to know in advance if everything is working properly. So if a hard drive fails, what do you do? And I prefer image backups because image backups will back up absolutely everything that's on the hard drive or a partition. And you can do multiple partitions all at once and so forth. So it'll back up everything, the operating system, programs, and the data. So everything that's on your hard drive. And it will restore everything. But you don't have to use it to restore absolutely everything. You can also do restoration of selected files or folders. So you can use it as an all-encompassing backup program where it'd be a disaster recovery, where you have to recover everything. You can also use it to recover files that get corrupted or accidentally deleted or whatever. You can automate it, which is another nice thing about image backups. I have it run at 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And if my computer's turned off at that point in time, it will run. I've set it to run shortly after I start up my computer. So you can automate it so you don't have to remember about it. My disaster. One day I turned on my HP laptop and it came up with a black screen saying boot device not found. A little bit heart-stopping. After a call to, a bunch of self-diagnosis on it and some trials and tribulations with some things that worked for a little bit and then didn't work again, I did call HP support. And after they worked over the phone trying various things, they finally came to the conclusion that, yes, indeed, the solid-state drive on it was failed. And so it got sent back to HP. They replaced the SSD on it, and they replaced the motherboard. So remember that because this became important a little bit later on. So what are my recovery tools? I have a bootable rescue disk that gets created, or I let the backup program that I use, which happens to be EaseUS to do backup, I go into the menus and I choose to make a bootable rescue disk. So you can make it either a flash drive or a DVD. So I have a rescue disk that's a flash drive. I also have the external hard drive that has my backup image on it. And you can run multiple backups onto a drive, and I typically do that, and I run it for multiple computers, all storing their images on the one hard drive. So I have a few of these around, and they have all my backup images on them. So here's my computer. It's an HP Spectre X360, and it has 3 USB ports. It has 2 that are Type-C, and it has 1 Type-A. Now, I have 2 Type-A devices. I have my flash drive is a Type-A connector, and my external hard drive with all the backup images on it is Type-A as well. So I'm in a little bit of a bind. I've only got 1 Type-A port on my computer. So there's a number of options. I could get a hub on the Type-A port. That's going to cost me a little bit of money. I might also need to be powered hub. I'm not sure, but it might need to be a powered hub in order to be able to drive both the flash drive and an external hard drive on it. But again, it's going to cost me some money. I could put one of them. I could put one of them onto a Type C by having a Type C to Type A dongle, and then plug either the flash drive or the external hard drive into the Type C port on that side of the computer. That would cost me money. I could decide to go to a Type-C flash drive or a Type-C USB drive and plug one of them onto that side of the computer. That would cost me money. And I'm a cheap SOB, so I prefer to avoid doing that. I could try to find a flash drive big enough for both the backup image and make it bootable as the rescue disk. But that would cost me some money. Or I could repurpose an old 1 terabyte external hard drive. So nowadays I find the 1 terabyte external hard drive for me is not good for very much. I've got a number of them that run up to 5 terabytes. And my smallest one other than this one I think is a 3 terabyte. But I did have one sitting on the shelf that was a 1 terabyte external hard drive. So I could use EaseUS to do backup and make it into a rescue disk. There'd be lots of space on it. So I could copy my backup image to that same drive, and then I would boot from the rescue disk, run EaseUS to do backup from the rescue disk. So when you plug it in, you start a computer from it, it actually boots right into EaseUS to do backup, where you can either do a backup or do a recovery. And then I could access the backup image that's on that same rescue disk. So one device plugged in there would allow me to boot, and it would also allow me to have the backup image on that same device. But I ran into a problem. As soon as I tried to do it, I was told by EaseUS to do backup that the rescue disk must be formatted as FAT32. Well, there are some limitations on FAT32. 32 gig maximum partition, and the maximum file size is 4 gigabytes. Well, my backup image, a single file, happens to be 147 gigabytes. This is for this particular laptop that I want to recover. So that's not going to work. So my final solution was I wiped the 1 terabyte external hard drive. I created a 10 gigabyte partition. I think I could have created probably would have gotten away with even a 1 gigabyte partition. But I created a 10 gigabyte partition, and I told EaseUS Rescue to make the rescue disk on that 10 gigabyte partition, which it happily did because it was formatted FAT32. I test booted from that drive to make sure that I could actually start my computer from that rescue disk. I then created an NTFS partition in the remaining 990 gigabytes of remaining space on that drive, and I copied my backup image from my original backup drive to that partition. And then I was successfully able to restore the entire image. So it all worked, but I still had a couple of other oddities that happened. Oops number two was that, remember on one of the early slides, I said that HP replaced the motherboard. Well, Windows Hello, which is what I use on all my portables, it requires you to set a PIN. And the PIN is actually stored on the motherboard in the TPM, which is the, I forget the name of it, Trusted Platform Module. And so the PIN is actually stored on the motherboard. So when the motherboard got replaced, the PIN disappeared. So I wasn't able to, like Windows Hello was able to recognize my face, but then it wouldn't log me in and said that there was no match for the PIN, which of course it didn't have because it had a new motherboard. I didn't know that Windows Hello actually worked this way. For some reason, it didn't like my password. And it did not see my Wi-Fi. And I might have been able to fix the password problem if I could have gotten out on my Wi-Fi and gotten to the Microsoft account on the web. Usually there's these functions that says, oh, if you forget your password, you know, you can do this, but it all always requires accessing Microsoft over the internet. And my Wi-Fi wasn't on, so I wasn't able to get out to the internet. So I was locked out of my computer. Now, remember that in a recent Q&A, I talked about the value of having an extra local admin account on your computer so you can fix problems. Well, this was one of the problems that happened to come up that it worked. So I logged in using that local admin account. So I knew what the password was. It didn't have to communicate with Microsoft servers to make anything work or anything like that. It's all totally local. And then I was able to connect my Wi-Fi. Once I got connected to the Wi-Fi, I was able to log back into the regular account. And then, for some reason, magically, I was able to use the password. So there was some communication somehow over the internet that happened with Microsoft servers that all of a sudden the password worked. And then I was able to reset the PIN, which, of course, stored it in the Trusted Platform module on the new motherboard, and I was back in business. So bottom line of all of this is think not only about your backups themselves. Think about recovery. Okay, it's always a good idea to test to see if you can actually boot from your rescue disk. Can you access your backup files while you are booted from your rescue disk? And do you have a local account with admin privileges that you can use in an emergency to get access to things and fix them, as I was able to do? Because if I hadn't had that, I'm not sure whether I would have been faced with, okay, I guess I have to just reinstall Windows from scratch. And have you practiced restoring at least a couple of files? I don't suggest that anybody should go and do a test to see if they can recover their entire hard drive. If something goes wrong, You don't want to lose everything, but you should at least practice restoring a couple of files while you are booted from that rescue disk and make sure that your processes work. I hadn't done this on my HP. Now, quite frankly, I thought I have enough resources around me that, you know, I have multiple computers, I have multiple drives, external hard drives, I have multiple flash drives. I knew that I could get something to work. But this really is a lesson learned sort of thing, that it's not a bad idea to practice your restoration processes. Be prepared. That's it for that mini presentation. If anybody has any questions or anything like that, by all means, I'm happy to answer it. You could unmute yourself or just like saying, I doubt I could have managed that rescue. Yeah, you could have. And a lot of it, too, is when it comes to issues like this, I mean, that's where the user group can be of value. And so if you have another working computer, ask a Q&A for advice. Maybe some people have some ideas of things you can try and stuff like that. Okay, I guess it's back to you then, Alan.
Okay. So, this is a question from Deb, and I very much appreciate this question, as I'll show you in a few minutes. And basically, the question is, can anybody recommend an all-in-one printer that prints, copies, and scans that's compatible with Ubuntu Linux 18.04? That's actually an older version of Linux these days. I say actually because I've already returned two incompatible printers, Brother and Hewlett-Packard, and despite claims that both models are good to go right out of the box. The Brother model required a download of printer drivers, but also a query to Brother, the manufacturer, and a technician messaging me with complicated instructions for downloading and installing the printer drivers. The instructions appeared to be commands, and I had no idea how or where to implement them. And my quote here is from George Orwell's 1984. I thought of Big Brother taking care of you, or as he said, watching you. But I like this. There was truth and there was untruth. And if you clung to the truth, even against the whole world, you were not mad. That kind of sums up people's experience with Linux, I think, and the command line. My experience is that I use Linux a lot. My experience is that you generally do need to download printer scanner drivers and install them. And I've got a Brother multifunction computer printer and a Samsung straight printer, and both of them offer Linux drivers, so that hasn't been a problem. Downloading the software is usually straightforward. However, as Deb found out, installation normally requires that you know a little bit about terminal commands, because it doesn't use a graphical user interface. And finally, getting the printer and the scanner to actually work. Usually everything works just fine, but it can be complex. So that's the good news. So my situation, I said this question was timely. I quite recently installed the latest version of Linux Mint, which is a kind of a cousin of Ubuntu, very similar to Ubuntu. It's based on Ubuntu, and it's using version 20. And I don't have a note that I actually installed the drivers, but the bottom line was the printer was working fine, which I use quite a bit. But normally I don't use a scanner. But then I had to do some. I had to scan a page, and I found, hey, no scanners detected. So my scanner wasn't working. So my solution was basically what Deborah was trying to do: download and install the software and the latest version from Brother Support Center, because my multifunction printer is a Brother device. So we go off to the website, and as I say, it's fairly straightforward. You put in the model number, and it basically brings you to a screen. You say, well, I want to find the downloads and the drivers, and you choose Linux in the menu here. And here's where you have a choice. You have to know whether your distro uses RPM packages or deb packages. And Linux and Ubuntu are both offshoots of Debian Linux, so they use deb packages. So once you know that, you know that you want the Linux deb version of the software. Next thing is, you notice down the bottom here, there's a bunch of printer drivers and a bunch of scanner drivers, but up here there's a driver install tool. And if we read the text, it says that it does both printer and scanner. So I downloaded that package, hopefully to do both at once. So then it gives you the magic EULA license agreement, and you agree to that, and it wants you to download this file. And you notice the file is an installer package, right? A Linux Brother printer installer, a certain version, and it's a .gz file. Now, gz is a zip format. In Linux, they use a zip format called gzip. So gz is a gzip archive-type file. And the other thing is, they give you a whole bunch of instructions on how to download and how to install the software. And you can see that here's the instructions. You can see there's a bunch of highlighted boldface commands here. But almost the first instruction is open a terminal window. So when Deb says she doesn't know how and where to type in these instructions, you have to know how to open a terminal. Well, in Linux Mint, it's actually pretty easy. Because right on the home screen, on the desktop, there's a button down here, which when you press it, basically opens up a terminal. Now, a terminal is like a DOS command window or a PowerShell command window. And so we can type commands right into that window. Other ways we can find that is by going to the main menu down here. If we click on that, then we bring up kind of the start menu. We've got a bunch of categories. We're looking at administration, then here is the terminal command. Or finally, the other thing we can do is we can use a keyboard shortcut. And this is fairly standard for a lot of Linux distros. Control-Alt-T will basically open that terminal. So if we go back to those commands, or the install instructions, and we basically have to change directory to downloads, because that's where we downloaded the file. And then we use a gunzip command to uninstall to extract the files from the gz zip file. And then it wants us to access super user access. So it's like being a Windows admin. You have elevated privileges. Because what we're going to do next is use a bash command, and bash is a command line program. So what it means is that our gz file is giving us a bash script. So we're going to run this script, and we're going to tag on the end the model number of our printer. Mine is a DCP7020. And then finally it said, when you see this, will you specify the device URI? If you have a USB connection, then say no. So those are the instructions we have to follow. And basically, we're going to do that in terminal. So up here, you can see I started off by doing the CD downloads, because the downloads folder is one folder below my home folder. But now I've cheated. I use an ls command. That's like a directory command, a dir command in DOS or Windows. So ls basically lists the files. So you can see I've got the gz file, and I've got some deb files here. But here is my Linux VR printer installer.gz. So what I've done now is I cheated slightly. Instead of typing all that stuff out, I've actually selected that, highlighted that file name, and done a a copy command. So normally you'd think Control C. In Linux terminal, you don't use Control C, you use Control Shift C. So that copies the text. So now on the next command prompt, I type G unzip space, and then I use Control Shift V to paste the file name, hit return, and it runs the unzip program. So that's kind of a shortcut way of doing, because I hate typing in lots of characters like that, almost certain to make a mistake. I'd much rather cut and paste. So then once it comes back, I do the same thing. I do an ls command again, because now you can see that I've unzipped some kind of file here. It's got no extension. But the instructions were to run bash on that file. So again, rather than use the sudo su command, I use a shortcut, and I simply just put sudo in front of my bash command, do my control shift V to get this file name in there, the script file. And then because I've put the sudo in, I haven't entered a password, the first thing it does is it asks me for the password for my username. Now note, when I gave that sudo bash script file command, I forgot to add the model name, the DCP720. It turns out it doesn't matter, because part of the script, if it doesn't have it, it actually asks you for those letters, that model name later on. So now what happens is you get a whole raft of Linux commands flashing by as it's doing this, it's running this script and issuing all these commands and all the responses and giving you a running total of what's going on until eventually, and you keep saying, yes, accept this, yes, do that, yes, I don't mind you using some disk space to install this software. And eventually it stops and it asks, will you specify the device URI? And if you remember, because we have a USB connection to the printer, the answer was no. So we hit no. And then it finishes up with some more commands when I get the right character here. And at the end it says hit enter, and then it goes back to a regular command prompt. And now I can just hit this X up here and close the terminal because I'm finished. So now I've installed and I've downloaded and I've installed the printer drivers. So now I can call up my trusty LibreOffice Writer program, pull in a text file, and send that job to the printer. And you can see that indeed down here my text file is going to my printer. So far so good. So now I call up my scanner and I'm ready to do my scan, and I think I've seen that error message somewhere before. No scanners detected. Now I've just installed the brand new drivers and the printer's working but the scanner's not. So now, and this is one of those, it usually works, but sometimes it doesn't, and it's complicated. So now I have to go to my other resource. And Chris says the guy that runs this Linux North blog seems to know what he's doing.
Absolutely brilliant.
This is 2018, a couple of years ago. He says, I recently did a clean install Linux Mint, sounds familiar, installed the drivers for my DCP7020, and the printer worked, but trying to run the scanner says no scanners available. So that's our problem. And at the time, he found another user on AskUbuntu who found out that some of the installation files may be copied to the wrong folder. Now, isn't that just marvelous? We have all this script file, there's all this automatic stuff, and it ends up copying the files to the wrong folder. And if you look what's going on there, there's a bunch of files in a folder called USR lib64 sane. And there's a bunch of files in there that have to go into this folder over here. So if I do that, if I open this folder, copy the files into that folder, then run my scanner again, I can find my mouse pointer. Then now, lo and behold, my scanner is ready to scan. So generally, it's easy to download the software. if you follow the instructions, it usually works pretty well. Occasionally, there can be a problem, and then you have to go to a different resource. And the beauty, I think, of Linux is it's user-supported, essentially. So there's thousands of people using Linux. Lots of them are much smarter than I am in terms of how to do it. And there's generally an answer somewhere. Now, Deb's second question, can anybody recommend at least one auto or computer technician who has ample experience working with the Ubuntu operating system? This mouse is a problem today. I have three technicians in Ottawa. Dr. Google, usually any problem you have in Linux, there, somebody on Google has a solution for you. It can be difficult to find the right one, and sometimes it's hard to phrase the right question, but usually you can find it. I like this forum called Ask Ubuntu, because it has a lot of problems and solutions that are specific to Ubuntu. They only take questions about Ubuntu Linux. Now, the nice thing is that Linux Mint is so close to Ubuntu that all of the solutions they provide also work for Mint, so I don't have a problem with that. And finally, Linux North, and this is actually my Linux blog. It's a maintenance blog, basically. When I run into a problem and I find a solution, I essentially make myself a note and post it as a blog post. It's a public blog, so other people have found various things useful. So the question now is for everybody else, does anybody know of a Ottawa computer shop that has Ubuntu support? Because I don't. You have to unmute yourself if you want to answer, or stick the answer in the chat window. And if you don't know, we're going to have to leave it at that, I think.
I think if anybody did, I would try Canada Computers. They have a lot of really smart people there. And I wouldn't be surprised if they have some experience with Linux. But it's a bit of a guess.
Okay. Okay, now a question that came in about half an hour before we started this meeting was essentially, can a personal web space be set up in Google Drive? And if so, can you tell us how to do it? And Chris said, well, this should be doable with any cloud storage that allows sharing of files and folders, and that includes Google Drive. But when I tried to do this, and I set up an HTML file quickly, and I uploaded it to my Google Drive account, created a link to that file, and opened it, the problem is it opens as a text file. It doesn't see it as a web page and decide to open it in the browser. Now, there may be a way around that. As I say, I haven't had time to play with it. But there are other ways to do it. And one of the easy ways, I think, is to use Google Sites. This is a free web server, essentially. And you can see here I've set up Glenn with a demonstration web page. So I've used these tools over here to set up a text box and add an image, and I changed the title, and then I'm going to publish the site, and when I publish it, it gives me the URL right here, so I can go ahead and publish it. And now if I type that URL into my browser, bingo, there is my web page. Not very sophisticated web page, but since I did it in like 5 minutes, I think it serves to illustrate the point. If you have an ISP and you have any kind of web storage space, And you should be able to create a personal website using your own ISP's web server and basically use FTP to upload files, and you'll have some kind of URL to get there. And it's always possible to purchase a domain name, an annual fee. It's about, I know, less than $20. And you can create, some kind of custom URL for your own personal website. Anyway, there's all kinds of different ways to do that.
Yeah, Alan, just in thinking briefly about it, I can see now why it didn't work just sticking HTML files on Google Drive. You really need a web server to read those files rather than a web client, I think. So this idea of setting up a free website is, I think, the best approach for sure.
Okay, so any other questions? Any other questions? Micheline actually has a question which she posted on the members forum. She basically, in a housing co-op that by law has to have an annual general meeting, but they can't have a face-to-face meeting with the number of people they have. So she's asking, is there any video and telephone conferencing system that will combine a video conference with a dial-in telephone conference? Because they need to have people that don't have computers join the conference as audio only. And so does anybody know of any video conferencing software that will do that? I know Zoom will, but it doesn't have a local Ottawa number. It has numbers for Toronto and Montreal and Timbuktu, I think, but it doesn't have a local number for Ottawa. So unless you have free Canada-wide calling, you're stuck with a long-distance call for probably a long annual general meeting. Anybody have any other suggestions? Shout at once.
Yeah, I don't know of any myself. I just wonder if Google Meet could do it. Phone use for Meet is only available if your phone number is in the U.S. or Canada. Use a phone for audio. Join using a phone. Oh, this is interesting. You can actually, apparently, with Google Meet, you can say from meet.google.com, select the meeting, join, use a phone for audio, and then you can click call me, and Google will phone you. So I presume that will actually work for, they say, anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. So it looks like Google Meet might be an option. However, I've never tried it.
Well, I'm sure Micheline will.
There's somebody who said could use 1010 229 for cheap long distance. And certainly that would be an option, too, if you wanted to use Zoom and use their Toronto or Montreal number. Yeah, there are a number of services like 1010, whatever, that you can have unlimited calls in Canada for probably 50 cents or a dollar or something like that. So that would be an option, too.
A cheaper option than having to buy like a Zoom account too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If somebody wants to partake in the meeting, they might figure it's worth the dollar or whatever. Yeah, I've used one of those services, if I can remember where it was, and figure out what the cost was for anywhere in Canada. Most of them they price it according to the destination country. So, yeah, I've used 1010, 620, unlimited minutes for like $2, I think is. So, yeah, that's not too bad. Like that was a price a while ago, so let me just see if it's Canada. If a second, I can get the current pricing. Unlimited calls for a dollar. So, yeah, you could set up a Zoom call. Yeah, there are numbers in Toronto or Calgary and Montreal. And people could call in using 1010 620, followed by that phone number, and it'll get billed to your regular phone number. Your monthly bill, it'll just show up, and unlimited unlimited time for one call for $1.
Hey, can you just drop the URLs for Google Meet and that telephone service into the chat window?
Yeah, sure.
And we'll have a record of it. And we're basically on 10 o'clock, so I think we're kind of done. So I'll just move along here and remind everyone that on September the 14th, the library is kicking off its fall session of Tech Cafe. And your favorite presenter is giving Windows Performance Tune-Up at 10 o'clock in the morning. And our next Q&A session, I think, will be next week, the 16th. So as usual, send your questions, any answers to questions that we post, and any topics that you'd like to share with the rest of the group to the suggestion box email. And thank you very much, everyone, for attending. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah, thanks much, everybody. Take care. We'll see you in a week.